Hello and welcome to New Books in World Affairs. I'm your host, Anna Levy. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Nikhil Pal Singh about his new book, Race in America's Long War, published by University of California Press in 2017. In this book, Dr. Singh explores links between race-making and war-making throughout U.S. history, arguing that each has provided continuous pretext for the other, from settler colonial wars to mass incarceration and the War on Terror. In the era of liberal multiculturalism, he argues, these links aren't diminished but simply take on new forms. Dr. Singh is Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis and History at New York University. He's the author of Black as a Country, Race and the Unfinished Struggle for Democracy, and the Faculty Director of NYU's Prison Education Program. I really enjoyed the conversation with him and hope you do too. Hi, Nikhil. Thank you so much for joining New Books in World Affairs. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
Yeah. You know, to start, the way we usually begin these interviews is just by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, what led you to write about the topics in this book, and a little bit about why this book right now.
Sure. So I've been working as a scholar and an academic for the last 20 plus years, and a lot of my work has been in African American history, the history of Black social movements, Black radical intellectuals, mostly set in the context of the 20th century history of the United States. One of the aspects of my earlier work was to explore the ways in which anti-imperialist and anti-racist politics have fused within Black social movements, particularly going back to mid-century, World War II, the Cold War, the 1960s kind of height of the Black freedom movement. So for a long time, I've been interested in critical traditions for examining the history of the United States and the world. And I saw a lot of the best thinking about the United States and the world from a radical and critical perspective coming out of the Black freedom movement, and particularly an analysis that recognized some of the interrelationships between domestic, what we might call domestic racial oppression and exclusion, and international processes in which the United States was implicated in the extension or continuation or reformatting of the colonial project. And I think in many ways that really culminates in the criticisms around the U.S. war in Vietnam. So that was a lot of my earlier work, and I think it formed the intellectual framework for what I began to do in this book. So my first book, my first single-authored book was it's called Black as a Country, and that's sort of where I dealt with that intellectual history I was just describing. And this book, Race in America's Long War, really grew out of the reflections I began to have with a lot of other people in the period after 9/11, particularly after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, and the dawning sense that many of us had that there was no end in sight to this war, that this war was open-ended. It had been declared in a way and authorized in a way that that made it so. And of course, it brought within its train many horrors, many very difficult and challenging moments. One of the biggest, initially, of course, being the embrace of torture in Abu Ghraib, the embrace of indefinite detention and torture in Guantanamo. And I think that I began to write about the wars. I began to think about how these wars were, in a sense, reauthorizing or relegitimating a kind of project in which the sort of constructed enemy or the construed enemy or the perceived enemy was someone who was seen as a person upon which it was possible to enact an extreme kind of violence without any kind of protection. And I began to think about how that was a recapitulation of legacies of American warfare that really take us back in time into this sort of the periods of colonial warfare and frontier warfare. So that was sort of one element and one thing that I was interested in tracking in the book. But in the context of what I just said a few minutes ago, I was also trying to think about how it was that the current wars also were raising questions that we had already been grappling with around the legacies and sort of ongoing realities of mass incarceration in the United States, a massive social project that begins to gain momentum in the United States in the 1980s, but really sort of takes off and accelerates in the 1990s. So just as the United States is launching the long war on terror, we also are finding ourselves at the high point of a regime of mass incarceration. So I was interested in kind of thinking about how these two phenomena are actually interrelated, that a certain kind of reduction in civil and civic status inside the United States, particularly for people of color who are disproportionately incarcerated, but really for anyone who is a prisoner in a sense, who is criminalized, and that in my thinking these two phenomena were related, and so I began to want to think about how to explore them and to braid an account that didn't separate out foreign policy and domestic policy, and that sort of drew forward what I just described earlier, this sort of longer tradition of thinking about how anti-imperialism, anti-racism are fused, how the way the United States treats its citizens and its and those who are not citizens in the domestic space, particularly those who are marked as other in various ways, also is carried over into U.S. foreign policy. So, and there's a sort of reciprocal relationship between the foreign and the domestic in the ways in which conceptions of security, conceptions of risk, conceptions of otherness, who is an object of state violence, that these are actually a kind of single field, and it's important to think of them together.
Excellent. So that brings me to the next question, which is the book draws on and contributes heavily to many different disciplines. I mean, just to name a few: settler colonial studies, critical race theory, critical security and legal studies, gender studies. Can you talk about some of the different intellectual genealogies, thinkers that you pull together in these different chapters, and how the frame of war facilitates putting them in dialogue with one another?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is a book that's trying to think in a big way, but also in a sort of compressed way about a lot of really complicated processes. Obviously, I think that the two or three strands of thinking that were most influential as I was reflecting again on what's happening in the world and what's happening in terms of American foreign policy and American policing practices, that I was drawn to the literature on the history of the carceral state and its formation, which is now a very broad and interesting and comprehensive literature, where where people have really tried to make sense of how this experiment in mass incarceration, which sort of has run so far in the United States, leading to the United States becoming the largest, producing the largest carceral complex that the world has ever seen, and the largest numbers of people in prison, over 2 million, as I said, by the turn of the 21st century. So that literature was very important to me, and I mean, I could certainly go into talking about specific works that have influenced me, but one of the really important ones was a work by the Marxist geographer Ruth Wilson Gilmore called Golden Gulag, which really tells the story of the rise of the prison complex in California in the 1990s. And Gilmore has a really important argument where she's thinking about the prison in terms of political economy. So what kinds of political and economic processes is the policy decision to build prisons and to funnel populations that are, in a sense, now underemployed or surplus to the requirements of the economy into prison. So where is that coming from? And she also tries to connect that to an account of sort of racialization, or what we might call the re-racialization of populations in the aftermath of the civil rights era, in which at least we get some kind of formal acknowledgement that black people in particular are full citizens. But that moment in which full citizenship emerges is also the moment in which the crime is given an additional moral salience and becomes a mechanism for in a sense re-stigmatizing people and for funneling people, especially people who are poor and people who are spatially isolated in cities, who have less access to services and to employment, into a kind of a carceral and police organized process, right? So that history of the relationship between the rise of the prison, of the racially targeted processes of incarceration, and how they grow is sort of one kind of line of thinking that I'm following in the reading that sort of brought me to write this book. A second line of thinking would be people who have written in really important and comprehensive ways about the history of counterinsurgency. And counterinsurgency, as you probably know, has a long history. It in some ways goes back to sort of late 19th century colonial thinking about small wars against kind of racially benighted colonized peoples. And it has a kind of a French lineage, it has a British lineage, it has a Dutch lineage. I mean, basically all colonial powers were fighting, what they called small wars, or what they didn't even necessarily think of as wars to civilize people. But essentially they were wars of pacification. They were wars designed to control populations where colonial powers were interested in extracting resources or extracting labor or creating various kinds of infrastructure and routes for the circulation of their own good manufactured goods and so forth. So there's a long history of colonialism and counterinsurgency that really goes back to the late 19th century, and it really tracks forward all the way through the 20th century. And during Vietnam, the United States really takes up the mantle of counterinsurgency in some new ways to fight the Vietnam War. Again, it's not talked about in the 1960s in expressly colonial terms, because the United States makes the claim that it's not fighting a war to colonize Vietnam, but to allow for a free nation that's not dominated by communism. But the language of counterinsurgency and the way in which the thinking sort of develops is drawing heavily upon these earlier traditions. And then, of course, during the Iraq War, particularly as the United States begins to face the Sunni insurgency, a lot of these counterinsurgency ideas about how you pacify restive insurgent populations come back into vogue. And David Petraeus, I think he wrote his dissertation on Vietnam. They sort of pull forward these sort of older histories that are rooted in accounts of the French pacification of Algeria, of Britain in Malaysia, of the United States in Vietnam, and so forth. So there's this long arc of counterinsurgency thinking, and one of the best books on this is a book by Lala Khalili called Time in the Shadows, which really sort of deals in a very remarkable and comprehensive way with these different lineages, these different strands, and sort of shows how they were interrelated. So that's a kind of second line of thinking that was really, really interesting to me. And then a third line of thinking would be the new work that has emerged really in the last decade on a kind of indigenous resurgence in North America. There's been a lot of incredible work on North American settler colonialism in both the U.S. and Canada, kind of extending to the Pacific Islands. And, of course, there's work also in Latin America that's very important, but I tend to be more focused in some ways on the North American literature for obvious reasons. And in some ways what this literature has done is not only shown how questions of settler colonialism remain very contemporary. In other words, they're not really questions of the past, they're questions of the present. There's still an indigenous presence, and there's still a project of settlement that is ongoing, and you can see it sort of flare up in the most obvious way in the conflict around Standing Rock, for example, recently. But I also think that the work on indigenous resurgence and settler colonialism in North America draws upon, a longer intellectual tradition of really thinking about how central the frontier was to organizing American conceptions of belonging, of nationality, of the exceptionalism of American notions of kind of freedom and self-government. I mean, if you go back to something like Frederick Jackson Turner's essay on the closing of the frontier, written in the late 19th century, and the way frontier expansionist conception of American history sort of grows out of that and continues to be operative in the ways in which the U.S. thinks about itself in the world, and the ways that frontier expansionist conception of history continues to work really is an important part of how I think we need to understand what leads the United States into Vietnam, what leads the United States into Iraq and Afghanistan. These wars are often understood or framed as defensive or about security, but in many ways they're also in a sense kind of part of the kind of American DNA that if you're not growing and expanding, if you're not demonstrating the sort of efficacy of American kind of martial and military power in the world, that in some sense you're going to be at risk of either losing out or losing a place or of a future in which Americans are going to be dispossessed. There's a sort of way in which the American internal kind of settler conception of freedom is one that we still haven't really undone, and I think that there's a really strong focus on that in a lot of critical work. People like Glenn Coulthard, who's writing out of Vancouver, an indigenous political theorist, Audra Simpson at Columbia, and Aziz Rana, whose book "The Two Faces of American Freedom," on kind of the concept of settler freedom, was also very influential to me. So, I could go on. I think I'm probably better off stopping there. But there are all these lines of thinking that are coming into the book. And as I say in the preface to the book, I'm not expressly engaging with individual scholars and their arguments, because I'm really trying to build a kind of argument of my own and not get sort of bogged down in a more scholarly book. I mean, it's meant to be a more public facing kind of book. But those are some of the strands of thinking that are behind it.
Would you be able to expand a little bit? I'm not remembering the quote exactly, but as you were speaking, there was one quote I remembered, something along the lines of, regarding sort of this founding idea of America, that the concept of liberty had to be reconciled with the development of a criminal enterprise. And I know I'm not getting the quote exactly right. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about these two ideas working together, this idea that liberty has to be paired with some notion of criminalization for the American project to keep moving forward.
Yeah, I think I know what you're referring to. So I think there's a tendency to argue that race thinking and racialization emerges to reconcile the contradiction between notions of universal liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all men are created equal, the kind of Enlightenment egalitarianism that informs the American Revolution and the French Revolution, that racism develops as a kind of counter discourse to reconcile the discrepancies and contradictions that are coterminous with these professions of universalism and inclusion, right? So we know that along with the Declaration of Independence and other sort of great charters of human freedom, there is the defense of Atlantic slavery. The slave trade may be outlawed with the origins of the United States, the transatlantic slave trade, but slavery continues and the internal slave trade begins to develop. Of course, you also have the acceleration of frontier expansion with the Declaration, a kind of a taking off of the gloves or the shackles now that American settlers are free to lay claim to more of the territory. And those projects, of course, involve an enlargement of the realms of human unfreedom, both the shackling and direct coercion and seizure of black bodies, and also the seizure of lands that are already inhabited by people who are recognized. And who then have to be in some ways unrecognized or dematerialized, even eliminated, right? So those projects, are often framed as though they are contradictory projects, right? One would seem to run directly against the grain of the other, and racism is often thought, the racism that is then applied or that then grows in the space of that contradiction, is often thought to be a kind of a discourse of justification, right? A way of sort of saying that, well, we can do this to black people, or we can do this to indigenous people because they are in some sense lesser beings. They have some kinds of deficiencies. They have some kinds of irredeemable characteristics that don't require us then to treat them as equals, right? And I think, there's something that's always been unsatisfying about that way of thinking about how racism develops. For one thing, I think it tends to think of racism as a primarily ideological construction, as opposed to something that actually emerges very tangibly in an encounter. And I think it also sort of allows for people to think somehow that racism is a sort of anachronism, You know, it was just the way people thought at the time. You know, they saw blacks and Indians as less than human. You know, and the thing is that it wasn't really the case that they saw people as less than human as a sort of separate body of thinking. They actually enacted and practiced something in which people were violated. Right, directly in their embodiment, in their lands, in their social relations, you know, by a kind of process that was articulated as an expansion of the realm of freedom. You know, and I think that's a much more complicated and difficult thing to get our minds around. It doesn't allow us as a kind of a compartmentalization. As if these are two separate things, you know, racism on the one hand and a kind of universal liberty on the other hand. It puts them into a much more tight relationship. And one of the reasons I start to talk about criminalization in that context is because I think that it's something I see and others have seen really right there at the origins. I mean, we think of the contemporary moment in which criminalization is so important and so braided with notions of racial difference. But if you go back, you know, to think about the early republic, already there's an awareness on the part of many American statesmen that what is happening on the frontier is actually a crime, that Indian lands are being stolen, that Indians are being murdered. And they're trying to figure out what to do with that fact, right? And similarly, I think, for those who are looking at the slave trade, they're not sort of just people of their time who are easily rationalizing this. They also realize that it is criminal, that it is a kind of a criminal activity to basically kidnap people, right? To kidnap people from their homes. So the challenge really is how do you rationalize a criminal enterprise that is actually really at the core of building a new state? You know, and there are two criminal enterprises. There's the criminal enterprise of land theft, and there's the criminal enterprise of seizing black bodies. And there are arguably others, perhaps, as well. But those two are very foundational and they're very formative. And I think one of the things that I'm suggesting is that the question of crime, right, then really becomes part of how the process gets worked out. That one of the things that begins to happen is that the question of who is a criminal and whose activity is criminal sort of begins to subtly shift, right? So you know, Benjamin Franklin will say things like, "It is in the nature of the slave to be a thief," right? And indigenous counterviolence, really beginning quite early, is going to be recategorized. Not as a struggle between two kind of coeval parties with an equal claim to the land who are fighting it out, but as people who are exercising an illegitimate or uncivil kind of violence, right? And that's part of, to me, the crucial piece of the dynamic through which kind of racial difference and racially differentiated understandings of who is a threat, who is a criminal, who is an object of violence gets constructed, and whose violence gets to be enacted and understood as a kind of part of a civilizing project and therefore in some sense not really violent. You know, I think that there's a way in which we shroud our own mechanisms of state violence, of legitimate violence, you know, behind these kinds of notions that suggest we are actually, we are only violent because we are trying to prevent a criminal counterviolence, right, that is sort of coming towards us. But that's a remarkable kind of sleight of hand, right? It's a And you see that sleight of hand operative in so many moments throughout our history, where we can never really fully take the measure of the criminal nature of our own violence. And by our, I mean our state, the state to which we are, in some sense, accountable, and that's accountable to us if we are members of that state. Does that help clarify the point?
Yeah, absolutely, and it brings me to one of what I think is one of the central ideas or propositions that you're making in the book about race making and war making being these co-constitutive processes. One is constantly happening with the other, and I'd like to know if you can talk a little bit about that in historical context of wars that we think of as wars and wars that you describe that maybe the general population of the United States wouldn't necessarily hold in their historical memory as a war.
Right. I mean, I think now it's, you know, it may be common to talk of the Indian Wars. You know, certainly the language of war, you know, is sort of ubiquitous in the way in which we think about American history. But in many ways, I think what I'm arguing is that from a fairly early point, there's a recognition that, first of all, there's tremendous asymmetry, certainly by the middle to late 19th century, in the power of the sort of industrializing United States and the native peoples who are still trying to preserve their relationships, their social relationships, and their relationships to the land, but that are being displaced by American expansion. So there's an asymmetry in power, in technology, and that's certainly part of the story. But as I just said in my previous answer, you know, insofar as indigenous counterviolence is re-described as criminal and thought to be within the purview of a domestic policy, right? The language that John Marshall in the Supreme Court decisions, the famous decisions in the 1820s and 1830s, uses is that Indians are domestic dependent nations, right? So they're no longer people with whom you have to have a kind of concept of again coevalness, of separateness, of people that you need to recognize. So it's no longer quite war, right? And what I'm arguing is it's more like a police action, right? It's more like people who must be policed, people who, when they're violent, we understand to be criminal. And it's that blurring of the lines between war and police that's very interesting to me, because I think we see that throughout, you know, again, this sort of longer history. And I think similarly, there's a way in which the slave population, particularly in the antebellum period, particularly in the South, is viewed as, you know, a potentially insurrectionary population, a population that could revolt. So in a sense, they're a foreign population, they're a foreign element, but they're also domestic, right? Because they're understood to be property, they're understood to be sort of within the plantation context and the plantation household. So there's a sense in which they are also primarily the objects of police. But it's a particular kind of policing, right? It's a policing that is imagined as being exercised against a population that in some ways, well, that in every way really has no rights, that need to be respected or acknowledged, and that are also kind of uniquely threatening, you know, because they're not seen as people that have any stake in the society, right? So there's that sort of logic again of how a kind of conception of policing that's informed by an understanding of a population that is its object, that is foreign, and that is uniquely threatening, right? So that sort of long shadow of sort of police action which I see as really core to the way in which processes of racialization have worked, really does carry forward, right? It carries forward into the U.S. wars and U.S. sort of period of U.S. overseas wars and colonial wars. The first major counterinsurgency the United States fights in the 20th century is in the Philippines. And it has all this similar kind of racialized logic. I mean, essentially, the United States is going to the Philippines to kick out the Spanish and then to help the Filipinos become self-governing. I mean, that's the sort of ostensible language. And, of course, the United States stays there for 50 years, occupying the island, you know, and in a sense, engaged in a kind of a long history of counterinsurgency and pacification. And all of that's about building up policing infrastructures and policing capacities. So, of course, it's warfare, but it's warfare in which you don't need to recognize the population that you're fighting as coeval, as having the rights of combatants that a war with another state would entail, right? So that long history of sort of understanding populations that don't have sovereignty, that don't have rights, that may be deemed in some ways as having various kinds of congenital incapacities, can now be subject to a certain kind of unlimited violence. And it may be called warfare, but the concept that's really crucial is the concept of police power, which is seen as very elastic, right? And in a sense, really, that is part of what we see carrying forward into the contemporary moment. I mean, the Bush administration's really, really great innovation was, or what they imagined as an innovation, was to think that, you know, really you were fighting a non-state, and you're fighting a non-state enemy, which obeys no recognized laws of war, and therefore you don't have to follow these long established precedents of how you wage war according to, say, the Geneva Conventions, and you can treat what come to be called enemy combatants as people without any kind of substantive rights or protections or due process or anything like that, you know. And that's out of the legacy of colonial and frontier and slave policing, you know. And that's part of the sort of the long thread that I'm trying to pull through, you know, in a somewhat economical and perhaps at times telegraphed way, through some of these chapters in the book.
Could you talk a little bit about the wars on drugs and the war on terror, so-called or not so-called?
I think that's a good follow-up.
Do want to ask it in the context of this idea that you also put forward between inner and outer wars, and the blurring of lines between states and sort of amorphous general others. How do these two ideas of war factor into what you're putting forward?
Yeah, so I've used this, I developed this kind of idea or this figure of the inner war and the outer war, and that's a way of sort of, for me, of kind of, again, trying to think about this single frame in which American state violence and thinking about security and thinking about populations, you know, and processes in the world that represent threat are simultaneously internal and external. That they tend to get articulated together or mapped onto one another, partly because of the ways in which these longer histories of having had internal populations that are imagined as enemy populations or populations in need of pacification or elimination really shape American political culture in the first century of the nation's development. So that inner and outer war is I don't know if I would call it an analytical claim. It's more like a heuristic that I'm using in the book, and it's an effort to, again, sort of disrupt the notion that foreign policy and domestic policy, particularly in matters of security or the exercise of state violence, is truly separable in the way we think about it. I mean, there's a whole way of thinking about American foreign policy that emerges out of the kind of origins of the national security state in the middle of the 20th century that really reifies foreign policy. It thinks about it as a sort of a domain that's very separate and subject to kind of special kinds of expertise. And it's a kind of a space of elite statecraft that's sort of insulated from sort of popular pressure, popular accountability, but also kind of internal processes in which Americans are continuing to grapple with these histories of racial division, of racial violence, of these histories of settlement and of the ways in which those have conditioned sort of regional histories, regional racial languages, regional divisions between populations, and so forth. And that also, of course, includes the border and the borderlands and sort of the question of how migrants fit into this and so forth. So all of that internal stuff is not actually set apart from the history of U.S. foreign relations after World War II, even though these are imagined as entirely separate domains. So I'm really trying again to kind of push against that throughout wherever I can talk about it, whether it's sort of the way in which the border patrol emerges and the border becomes militarized during World War II in ways that actually involve like the explicit transfer of military, you know, hardware, you know, to the border, you know, or the ways in which Japanese internment, you know, which, you know, maybe we tend to kind of think about as a separate or exceptional moment within World War II, is in fact far more indicative, again, of the way in which war overseas induces a kind of question and a set of practices directed and targeted towards an enemy population. And of course, the long history in which African American populations and people, particularly after particularly beginning in World War I, but even really going back to the Civil War, try to use war and war fighting and especially overseas war fighting to make the claims that they are now entitled to full citizenship. So war always entails some kind of renavigation or recalibration, or as I said, reformatting of these kind of internal processes. So to bring it forward to sort of the beginning of your question to the war on drugs, or really the war on crime, which precedes the war on drugs. You know, when we look at the history of the war on crime, which is the phrase that really develops in the 1960s to make sense of kind of rising crime rates, or what are argued are rising crime rates in the 1960s, kind of street crime, but then also going forward, crimes related to the drug trade. And illegal drug use, or the illegalization of certain kinds of drug use, that the framing of that of those sort of phenomenon in terms of war, right, and become very much a part of a response to the urban crisis of the late civil rights era, you know, in which African American populations that have been, you know, sharply segregated in urban spaces over a generation are beginning to make demands, right? Demands that really grow out of the sort of longer civil rights imperative. And those demands, of course, are creating ruptures of a kind of spontaneous kind. The legacy of course of riots throughout the 1960s, the most important of which is the Watts riot. This sort of urban restiveness among black populations is going to be completely criminalized in the 1960s. And then the language in which it's criminalized is going to then get transferred onto the language of war again. So now we're fighting a war on crime. So in my earlier answer, I was sort of telling a story of how war informs a kind of a concept, an elastic concept of policing aimed at enemy populations. But in this part of the story, kind of going forward, American war making, right, which is understood after World War II as sort of part of the kind of keeping of the peace globally, that American military might and power is understood to be sort of crucial to the defense of the free world, is actually being kind of now turned inwards again onto domestic populations. And so the war on crime that really begins in the late 1960s is the sort of starting point, really, of the arc of mass incarceration. And this has been argued very strongly in a book by Elizabeth Hinton, which is entitled From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, and where she really shows this punitive turn, this policing turn. And she makes this great point that I pick up on in the book, where she quotes Lyndon Johnson saying, you know, the war on crime is a war within our borders, right? So once you start thinking about populations inside the country as being the object of war, you've really shifted the ethical and moral and policy compass in a way that makes it very, very difficult to come back from. I think we've lived the consequences of that. I mean, we've lived now with 30 years of a punitive turn, which have led to, you know, 2 million people and 2+ million people incarcerated, 8 to 10 million more people with various kinds of, you know, in the system, you know, with various kinds of criminal stigma attached to them. So I think it's 70 million Americans have a criminal record. I mean, it's astounding when you really start to sort of extrapolate out from the impact of this war on crime and of this war footing that is imagined to be at the center of the policing project in the United States after the 1960s. I think these are problems that are kind of hidden in plain sight. They become very normalized. But I think what I'm trying to say by really showing how the policing conversation and the war conversation, how the inner war and the outer war, how the long shadows of kind of race war that run through them, kind of buoy them, that there's nothing about any of that we should think of as normal. There's nothing about any of that we should not want to really confront in a very direct way, and to sort of recognize, I think, if I have an ultimate goal, you know, to recognize how this has really begun to sort of erode, you know, in a really profound way, what we would think of as the necessary basis of any civic order, a civic order being understood as an order in which we live through relations of trust and capacity to govern ourselves without this level of insecurity and violence.
It did take a while reading through the different parts of this book, seeing how you form it into a coherent whole, which is not linear by any measure. But what it does do is it responds in some way, or puts in dialogue this moment that we're in, that many people, you know, this political moment that we're in the United States, that many people are describing as exceptional, mobilizing around and having a lot more critical conversations around. And in the closing parts of the book, you put forward some analysis and some thoughts on this moment, how we got here, what is, but even more, what isn't so exceptional about it. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that sort of in closing, but also I want to ask if and where you're seeing, given sort of your own background, where are you seeing transformational politics taking place right now? And I also want to ask you, what does opposition to perpetual war, as you've described it, look like? What do alternatives look like?
Yes, those are great questions. I mean, especially the last question, which I must say the book doesn't really take up, but I hope to be able to take up more fully in talking about the book. So I'll come back to that. The first part of your question really, you know, is about the kind of what I call the present crisis in one of the last chapters, and I think that was. It was in some ways responding to Trump's election and some of the fears around it, some of the ways it was framed, some of the ways in which he framed his own claims that really kind of spurred me to pull this book together. I mean, as you say, it has a somewhat kaleidoscopic quality. It's not exactly a linear argument. They're braided essays that connect with each other and that I think hopefully thematically, when taken together, show this sort of picture that I'm trying to sketch in these comments. But I think, you know, yes, I wanted to really argue that Trump's not exceptional, we aren't in a kind of a unique moment of you know, what some people have called kind of norm erosion. I mean, it seemed absurd to me to think that Trump represented greater norm erosion than, say, the Abu Ghraib torture or even the launching of the Iraq War, which was, you know, a war that was launched on the basis of very specious kinds of evidence and certainly did not manage to convince international public opinion, which is at least something that used to matter, let alone the United Nations Security Council, which is already a body that is in some ways beholden to very dominant powers in the world. So you know, there's been a long erosion of American commitments to thinking really seriously about what is required to build a stable, consensual world order. And of course, I think those commitments have always been somewhat shaky, and they've always been sort of undermined by some of the things that I write about in the book, you know, including the sort of internal instabilities in the country that derive from these divisions around race, especially, and also the kind of expansionist impulse, which has led the United States into some ill-begotten wars, most of all Vietnam. So I'm not trying to. I don't have a kind of a sense that there was once a golden age, but I do think that in the immediate post-war period and coming out of World War II, which was obviously such a cataclysm in world history, unparalleled cataclysm in world history. But there was a level of seriousness in American thinking about how to operate in the world, a kind of a longer term a commitment to, you know, what some have called ethical realism, sometimes even a pulling back. I mean, from the brink of disaster, again, I want to be careful in how I talk about this, and in some ways this is part of the book that I'm writing now, which is really a book about the Cold War and the origins of American globalism, so it's on my mind. But I do think that over the last, you know, really 30 years or so, there's been a real degeneration and decomposition in serious American thinking about world, you know, kind of world comedy at a global scale, what the role of the United States should be. And I think in the post-Cold War period, there really is a resurgence of a kind of unilateralism and hubris and a belief that military power alone was kind of enough to sort of justify leadership, action, a kind of disregard for consensus and a kind of impunity, you know. And so I really think that's something that we're now sort of faced with a sort of a kind of further degeneration in the figure of Trump, the Trump administration, which seems to have absolutely no clue, you know, about what it's doing in the world. So there's been a corruption, really, of the globalist ideal, you know, and I know the globalist reality was, you know, left a lot to be desired, but I think the globalist ideal, which certainly was an ideal of a world shared in common, you know, in a world in which people actually have to work out relationships within terms that really present some limits to action. And obviously the ecological questions loom very large here. You know, I feel like we're not confronting those, and it's extremely dangerous in that sense. And I think obviously also the Trump logic really built very, very, very heavily on the inner war, what I call the inner war, you know, on the war on migrants, the war at the border, the war on crime, and the ways in which Trump talks about kind of urban black populations. Obviously, the war on terror, but internalized in relationship to the threat of terror within or infiltration from the outside by Muslims, and of course the successive efforts to engineer this Muslim ban. These are all part of a kind of a right wing discourse, you know, really going back to the 1980s and 1990s, and have been really important to creating a certain kind of constituency for politics on the basis of racial fear. And I think the Democratic Party has sometimes gone along and sort of not been very good at either inoculating people against that or really more frontally confronting that. I don't think the first Clinton administration was very good on that, and I write about that. And I think that, you know, in some ways, Obama was a break, you know, and I think Obama did represent something more hopeful, but there's a way in which that ends up being another sort of missed opportunity to really reorient the country, to redirect the country towards a more socially constructive sense of what kinds of policies do we need to actually produce, you know, to use a like old utilitarian language, the greatest good for the greatest number. To really think of the nation in sort of more holistic terms, across divisions, across differences, across inequalities. Instead, we really are in an age in which people are pushing polarization. You know, they're pushing all different kinds of polarization, economic polarization, but also racial polarization. And of course, as I argue in the book, those are very, very interrelated. So I'm trying to sort of, you know, I'm being a little abstract in this answer, but, you know, people who are interested hopefully can read the book and read the essay that really deals with Trump more centrally, because I think it stands up. I mean, it was written right after the election, but and in many ways Trump has not been very successful or efficacious as a president, which I'm happy for. But, you know, we're still in the early days, you know, and I think that the dangers are very much on the front burner in terms of what could happen, and I think we have to see. I do think, to sort of turn to the second part of your question on resistance and transformative tools and more kind of hopeful signs. You know, I do think we are in a political awakening in this country. I think it's been a long time coming. I mean, I do think even Obama's election was part of it. The Sanders campaign has contributed immensely. The so-called resistance to Trump. I mean, I think the various sort of social movements of the last 7 to 10 years, from Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter to now the Me Too campaigns around sexual violence. I think there's a lot of activation, you know, around the recognition of the ways in which we live in a a kind of civically punitive and violent society that is that sort of is disproportionately operative along lines of race and gender and sexuality, and of course economic deprivation. And I won't necessarily use the language of class here, but a deepening economic polarization. It shoots through and runs through all of those other questions, all the questions of race, gender, and sexuality. We don't yet have a left that really has a language at a larger scale that can sort of meaningfully contest for power in these terms. But there are a lot of green shoots, and there are a lot of places in which people are working really effectively at local and municipal scales. I think sometimes now winning state elections, maybe under the banner of the Democratic Party, but with a far deeper, sort of radical and egalitarian vision than we've seen in a long time. I think the promise of politics in America has always been there. You know, I think that really is part of the discourse as well. The idea that this is a democracy in which flows from popular self-government. Popular self-government gets distorted into populism and gets distorted into various kinds of exclusionary visions of the polity perpetually. But the idea of a kind of radical vision of self-government is one that I think we should be thinking about how to operationalize and actualize wherever we are, including in the institutions that we work in, like universities, or corporations, which are in many ways radically anti-democratic institutions, in which people are thought of as being, mere employees who sort of live by the grace of those who run those institutions, rather than participants in a meaningful process of creating community, in a sense. So again, going back to the past, not something I write about in this book, but something I've written about in my earlier work, the vision of the beloved community, the visions of the radical civil rights movement that really were about a kind of a reinvigoration of a kind of inclusive popular democracy that was fundamentally aimed at reforming what King called these interrelated evils of racism, militarism, and materialism. I mean, those are ideas that run through the grain of the history of the United States and the kinds of oppositional movements and social movements that we've had, and those are still very, very palpably and powerfully a part of the world that we're in, and they're the promise, really, that we have to draw upon. And I'd only add to that we really need to have those envisions infused with a much stronger sense of the problems that are imperiling our shared ecology, the challenges that are imperiling our shared ecology, and that are really going to, I think, require us to rethink a kind of idea that that very few people are willing to rethink, which is the idea that our economy needs to be run on a notion of kind of perpetual growth. Perpetual growth is a little bit like perpetual war. It's a kind of faith, that if we don't grow, we're somehow going to die. We're somehow going to fall back into some kind of much darker, every person for himself kind of world. But in a way, that is the world that is now being produced by this commitment to perpetual growth, because we aren't thinking carefully about what it means to steward the resources that sustain life on the planet, and not just for human beings. So I really do think we're at a profound moment in our history, and it's a bit of an impasse, and it's a bit hard to see how it's going to go. I mean, Trump is by no means the last word on this, and what comes after Trump could be much scarier than Trump, or really this could be a moment where we start to really really turn things around and sort of chart a new course.
And just in closing, thank you for that. I mean, there's truly a lot to think about, and the internet and sort of the digital age was something that I was going to ask you a little bit more about, gatekeepers and whatnot, and how these narratives are shifting. I'll leave it to maybe a future conversation and encourage people to pick up the book. But in the meantime, just as a closing question, maybe you could tell us what you're working on now.
Sure. Well, I have a few different projects. I'm the faculty director of a prison education project. So we're building a program here at New York University to provide college education to people in prison, people coming out of prison. And it's really it's been about a 5-year project, and it's kind of reaching a very a very constructive point. We've had 5 students gain an associate's degree from NYU inside prison, and we have students coming out of prison who are continuing on to do their BAs, and so it's a big part of the work I've been doing. It's a kind of institution building work. It's a kind of movement work or network, social network building work in New York City that really is about trying to redress and challenge the baleful legacies of mass incarceration in our city and state. And people can learn more about that by just looking up prison education I think it's just prison education at NYU. If you Google that, you'll find our website, which tells a lot about the project. I'm finishing a new book that should be coming out hopefully in a year, called Exceptional Empire, Race, Colonialism, and the Origins of American Globalism, which really is a more of a historically researched monograph looking at the period from World War II through the Vietnam War. So the kind of early Cold War is the sort of center of the book, and I'm really trying to tease out the arguments about how the United States is really going to confront colonialism and the ways in which ideas about racial hierarchy and colonial hierarchy are continuing to sort of shape and direct American thinking about the world, even though that thinking is sort of being recast in a more globalist and again kind of universalist idiom. So that book is in process, and then I have another piece coming out next month in N+1 on some research that I've been doing with Professor Tweeland too, my collaborator, which is right now that the piece is focused on Alabama in the present day and on efforts to bring back manufacturing in Alabama, and it's really about some of the race class conflicts in Alabama right now. And Alabama is a really interesting place to look closely. Obviously, we have this upcoming special Senate election, which is on everybody's minds, and we have an attorney general from Alabama whose own lineage really takes him through back to the high era of post-war white supremacy. And so I'm working on a project that's really about race, labor, and the American South that I think will be something that probably is gonna be something I'm working on for the next 2 or 3 years, and it's a collaborative project. But the first piece of that is coming out probably next month. So those are some of the things I'm doing right now.
Great. A lot to look forward to. I just want to thank you so much for joining again. I know this all happened sort of quickly. I think I had actually reached out to you originally about the book that's going to be coming out, Exceptional Empire. And you said, actually, I just wrote this other book. So I'm glad that it worked out. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for your interest and taking the time to ask me such great questions. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about the book. Só no ar humano dia já posso sentir na pele amar e deixar sua assinatura de sol na cara como uma pele.